One other thing, I had an idea that we could read, if we have time, we could like do a bonus where you read something from Spiked, although I couldn't really find anything funny because it's all like really disgusting. It's like way worse than it was last time we did one of those. It's extremely transphobic and Zionist now.
It used to be kind of funny, but now it's like homophobic and terrible.
He did write something about Oasis, which could be funny.
Yeah.
They're all writing for The Spectator now. And The Spectator famously had an article a few years ago called In Defense of the Wehrmacht, basically like saying that the Nazis were good.
Cool, man. Well, Brandon O'Neill is really, he's really doing it. They're maybe trying to become the voice for Reform UK. I don't know if you would have time to do that bonus, but Andy, I like the idea that Oasis article, if only because Brandon O'Neill is so ridiculous and the premise of it is, it seems insane to me as an American. Maybe Max, you'd have time to, you know, a half hour or so to bring us through what this culture war around Oasis is. I don't know. Up to you.
Yeah, we'll see if we have time.
I don't really know much about it, to be perfectly honest.
All right, episode 303. Let's fucking go. me. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. This is Sean, of course, and I'm here with Andy. This is episode 303. Ever since we got to episode 300, I've just been so hyped about the numbers. We are joined by a very special guest, one of our cousins, as they say in the Secret Service world, a British man by the name of Max Shanley. Welcome, Max, to the Antifada.
Hello.
Oi, Max.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oi, bruv.
Andy, please refrain from making any Cockney impressions or saying core blimey or even the L word. Don't use the word limey.
I can't give a respectable oi to my bruv. That's no good.
I don't know, Max.
Is that insulting? Is that a microaggression?
Sup, bruv. Sup, bruv.
You say sup? We say sup.
Yeah, we all say all right, bruv.
All right. We're not so different.
Like I said, cousins. I'm going to practice oi, bruv. He's going to practice. Well, he's already got sup down. So, I mean, I feel like already on this podcast episode, we're coming to some important connections between us. Max, you first came across my transom, which is to say my social media feed, about 10 years ago, I'd say, at this point, because in a good way. I want to promise you in a good way. I heard you on some podcasts and I was aware of some of your writings. And this was around the time a gentleman, an older gentleman by the name of Jeremy Corbyn had won. He had got some momentum behind him and he had won leadership of the Labour Party. And I remember you being an interesting figure. And trust me, I mean this very nicely here. You were somebody who was like not kind of maybe like fully part of the Novara world or the Momentum world. Maybe you were in Momentum, but you seemed like an outside critical observer, which I always appreciated. And I do remember you coming in for a lot of hatred from maybe the center and maybe the right. So it was a real pleasure for me a couple weeks ago to look and see that not only are you still active, but you got a great Substack and you're confronting directly the problem facing the left in the UK right now, the problem of course being the Labour Party. So thanks again for coming on the show, and yeah, we're really pleased to have you.
My pleasure.
Now I have a bit of a gotcha question to begin this, and then I think we'll throw it to Andy. He's got some kind of background questions about the UK. We're always interested in the UK here on this show. Sometimes we have Trash Future on, sometimes we have Max Shanley on. But here's my gotcha question for you. What is your preferred nickname for your prime minister? Is it Never Hear Keir? You know, which is a reference to the fact that you've got all these domestic problems, but he seems to love to fly to Paris or take the train to Kiev and do foreign policy stuff. So do you like Never Hear Keir, or do you like Kid Starmer instead of Kim Starmer? Keir Starmer, rather. Which would you prefer?
There's a far better one, which always gets on his nerves. Yeah, that's calling him Keith. Calling him Keith, not Keir.
Keith? Like weed?
No, Keith. Well, Keith is in K-E-I-T-H. Yeah,
okay. Keith. Like cool Keith. Keith. No, let me put this in terms that Andy can understand, like cool Keef, not okay. Like smoking the Keef, you know what I mean?
If you're an anti-imperialist and you support Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine, maybe you could call him Keef Starmer.
Oh, nice.
Oh, I think he'd get him right off his socks, that would.
Yeah, we don't want, I think, you know, I prefer Kid Starver. If only because I feel like it's got a nice ring to it.
It's also quite literal.
Yes. No, I mean, in Gaza, I think he has, as much of our ruling class does across the West, he's got blood on his hands as much as anybody else. So not Kid Starver and not Never Hear Kier, but a secret third thing, which is Keith Starmer. Just really fucking giving it to him. I like that. Thank you for that. Andy, you had some background questions. We're fascinated about what's happening in the UK. These days, it seems hard to get information. So, Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's part of why I think it's so fascinating for US leftists is that the Labour Party in the UK does have this social democratic history, and you've been a part of it for quite a while. So I just want to start out asking you about your history in the Labour Party.
I joined the Labour Party in 2011, the start of 2011. I'd been a trade union activist before then, and my sort of turn towards politics was really as a result of coming up against the limits of industrial unionism. I'd worked in a very well-organised workplace, and the union had been smashed. So I started looking for other answers. You know, I came to the conclusion that, you know, just focusing on the workplace wouldn't solve everything. So then I joined the Labour Party, and then in 2013, I was elected to the National Committee of Young Labour, which is the youth wing of the Labour Party. At the time, like the rest of the party, that was dominated by the right. In many ways, the right wing of Young Labour are actually worse than their sort of adult counterparts. They're a lot more cruel. They don't really stand for anything at all. And they're very much sort of like cutthroat people. That's one thing I actually quite admired about them, to be perfectly honest, was the ruthlessness. So I was on their committee as a minority, and well, you know, they all hated me, and that sort of bled into the adult party as well. And then obviously,
did they call you a Trotskyist?
Oh yeah, no, they called anyone to the left of, I don't know, name some really terrible American liberal.
Oh, I was going to say Ed Miliband, but a horrible American.
Hillary Clinton.
Pete Buttigieg.
They thought Ed Miliband was a Trotskyist.
That's incredible.
Like they're just so ridiculous.
I can only imagine what these fucking people look like. I don't know if you have a term there in the UK, a Poindexter. I imagine they look like fucking Poindexters. Like, they look like the biggest fucking ghouls, like little tiny Pete Buttigieg with like shitty limey accents. I can only imagine what you had to confront in there, man. You fought your way out of that, I guess.
I mean, you're kind of right. I mean, you know, you would go to Young Labour conferences and Labour Party conferences more generally, and you would see 16-year-olds in suits thinking that they're like the big I am, and they're all the important mission because they were a party conference or whatever.
And these weren't ska fans. These weren't ska fans. These were just 16-year-olds in like serious business suits. Ugh.
Yeah. Who believed that, you know, they were the future of British politics, and that if they said the right things and they cozied up to the right people, then one day, you know, they would be running the country. I mean, what always used to make me laugh is the exams you take at school before you leave school to go to university in the UK are called A-levels, right? And whenever there was a Young Labour election, there would always be
someone who submitted as their like candidate statement, vote for me, I have an A-level in politics. As God. If like that was, you know, oh my God, on A-level in politics. They're just
a you're certified to be a good politician, right? Certification. That sounds so familiar. We have a political party called the Democrats, and these people sound like they'd fit right in.
Oh, they love the Democrats as well. I mean, the thing about the right wing and the Labour Party in general, that, you know, all you really need to know about them is that at least once a week, they sit down in front of the telly, trousers down, dick in the hand, watching the West Wing, but
brushing it off. That's a beautiful image. So presumably you were not wearing a suit. You were maybe not getting the best grades. Or maybe you were, but you politically,
I did terrible.
But you come from the labor movement, or you came out of the labor movement into labor. And so as the left is somewhat ascendant in the late 2010s, leading to Corbyn's campaigns, did you find yourself in a more prominent position in Labour, or at least in Young Labour?
The Socialist Campaign Group of Labour MPs, which is like the left caucus of parliamentary caucus, had a meeting, and I didn't go to it, but I knew somebody who was at it, John Landsman, the bloke who went on to found Momentum, and me and my friend Alex, who I sat on the Young Labour National Committee with, who was the head of the organising team on the 2015 Corbyn campaign. We actually sat in a Young Labour National Committee meeting at the time whilst this other meeting was taking place. And so they're having this meeting in Parliament to decide a candidate. Someone looks to Diane Abbott. She goes, no, I've done it before. Someone looks at John McDonnell. He says, I've done it before. He turns to Jeremy and it's your turn. But because it was such a pie-in-the-sky idea that A, we would even get somebody on the ballot, let alone win. And if I recall correctly, Corbyn turned to Landsman and said, you better not make me win.
I'm sorry to stop you here, but like this is all interesting stuff. You were here at the formation of a historic moment. Andy and I were, but we weren't nearly as close to power. You know, we were just kind of like guys who were around in New York. But you truly were like part of this world historic moment that we all lived through, which was the Brexit vote, which was Jeremy Corbyn, which was here in the United States, Bernie Sanders, a kind of return to like a previous generation's conception of social democratic governance. Bernie Sanders, and the reason it reminded me of that, he too was running as like a protest candidate because nobody else would, right? I don't think he had a sense that he was going to win or even get as far as he did in the primaries. So 10 years ago is this kind of pivot point because, of course, Donald Trump too is coming up at this moment in time. You were privileged to sit there at the front seat of this whole thing, and I guess you had the dubious privilege of watching the whole thing fall apart, right?
Yeah, no, it was a very frustrating time, particularly for me, because I wasn't exactly sat in the front row. I was on like the second or third row, but I knew all the people who were sat in the front row. And
they wouldn't even let me and Andy into the bleachers here in the United States. We couldn't even be bleacher creatures for it. So you were closer than we were.
And they, you know, and they expected anyone on the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth row to basically share responsibility for their decisions. So even when you disagreed with them, a lot of pressure was piled upon you not to say anything publicly. It was a very frustrating time.
So having that sort of front row seat, how would you narrativize how we went from Corbyn losing to the current crisis in labor today? And how would you characterize that crisis?
So it's built on lies, basically. When Keir Starmer ran for leader, he ran on a platform of essentially aping Jeremy Corbyn. and making himself out to be this long-time lefty, and that he, you know, had a history in popular struggles and everything like that. He pledged to push for the policies of the 2017 manifesto, not the 2019 one that Labour had just lost on, but the one in 2017 where it nearly won the election. And then immediately sort of stuck two fingers up at the party membership that had elected him and went in a completely different direction. Now, the thing is, anyone who was following it closely could see that that was the direction of travel he was going to take because of all the people that were around him. But to the overwhelming majority of Labour Party members who, you know, sadly, are a bit naive, they took him in good faith, and he took that good faith, and, you know, he trapped it in the bin, set it on fire, and then pissed on it. And that's why we're in the situation that we're in today, because he's just a liar, and his whole political career is based on fallacy. There's no truth to it at all. So you can't trust a single thing that comes out of his mouth. You know, and then you look at the last election and the fact that Labour won less votes in last year's election than they won in 2019, which is supposedly the worst ever election for the Labour Party since the 1930s or whatever. And yet, due to the peculiarities of British liberal democracy, they won an overwhelming majority of seats in Parliament. You know, so that those two things combined really do expose, you know, the sort of sham of British liberal democracy. Because you now, can either get someone lying or just through the inequities of the system.
Now we fast forward, or maybe we're rewinding a little bit, but Jeremy Corbyn's been thrown out of the Labour Party. I presume you've been thrown out of the Labour Party, or did you quit?
No, I quit.
Okay. So I guess, I'm sorry you weren't important enough, Max, to be thrown out of the party, but not all of us can be Jeremy Corbyn.
I mean, I don't know if you've heard about this report, the Ford report, which was an investigation into the Labour Party bureaucracy. And not the Ford report. The Ford report is what followed it. There was a report done by staffers in Corbyn's office on central party staff, essentially people who worked in the Labour Party headquarters. And they were greatly aided by the fact that one of Labour's executive directors had uploaded his entire WhatsApp archive onto the servers. He emailed them to himself, right? And basically what this report showed was that, you know, they were consistently trying to undermine Corbyn during his leadership. They were in tears when Labour nearly won in 2017. They thought it was the worst thing to happen in history. But another thing that was going on in their WhatsApp chat was that they were talking about me an awful lot.
Oh, that's great. So you made it. You made it into the public record.
One of the things they discussed was that they had a desire to set me on fire.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
Take over my head and set me on fire. Yeah.
Well, that's not funny. That's not good. That's not good at all. We prefer you unburnt.
It's kind of like, you know, you're supposed to be the nice guys. They're the self-professed nice guys. We're the evil ones, right? The left are the devil. They're the angels, right? I don't know anyone on the left who's ever talked about firebombing someone, but
I'm sorry that that kind of rhetoric was floating around. That sounds really intense, and we can laugh about it. But obviously, these are people with a tremendous amount of power internal to the Labour Party, and then in government and across British society, I suppose. But this all leads me to a question, which is like beyond the personalities, beyond Keir Starmer's, as you say, proven track record of lying. What were the sort of structural impediments to turning labor into something maybe would be more familiar from like the 1920s or 1930s. What was the impediment to turning it into a Benite party or a Corbynite party structurally?
Yeah, so you really do have to go back to the origins of the Labour Party and how it's structured. And I think the best way of articulating that is that the Labour Party, in its structures, practices and modes of behaviour, reflects capitalist society. You have a tiny elite at the top who have all the power, and then you have this great mass at the bottom who are the membership, and who from time to time get to elect a party king or a party queen, and to whom they're all expected to obey. And then you have the sort of parliamentary parties, the aristocracy, who we must all defer to and be kind to and never criticise. And, you know, so it's part that, part a fan club. Deep down, most MPs just want the Labour Party to be a fan club for them and to, you know, put money in their campaign accounts and everything like that. That combined with a bureaucracy that is overwhelmingly on the right and has been staffed by the right, you know, since the dawn of time, meant that it was incredibly hard to drive through any real changes to the Labour Party constitution or its practices or anything like that during the Corbyn era. And this was further compounded by the fact that the leadership adopted a strategy of essentially trying to placate the right wing of the party. And the way that they aimed to placate the right wing of the party was by just not trying to reform the party at all.
Because the right wing was happy with the arrangement such as it existed.
They were happy with the arrangements as it existed. Also, the leadership got this silly idea in their heads that they were a hop, skip, and a jump away from being the next government. So they felt that they had to keep the right wing on board, basically. There's this old saying in the Labour Party, you know, it's like a bird, you need two wings to fly, a right wing and a left wing. Well, that's just dumb. You should shoot the bird.
It was just an interesting comment you made before that you admired the ruthlessness of the labor, right?
Yeah.
Which I totally understand. I mean, I think like if I've heard some people say that if the Corbyn wing had been a bit more ruthless, maybe the it would still be a left party today, but that's not the situation we're in. We're in a situation where we're looking at a new party forming. Not only around that sort of late 10s Corbyn moment, but also the previous election where Corbyn and a number of other independents were able to win seats. And this is tentatively called as a placeholder your party now. And they're heading towards their first convention. And a lot of people have some differing ideas of what this party is going to look like and how it's going to operate. And you're one of them. So, maybe let's talk a little bit about what your party is going to look like, what the different ideas are, and your opinion on it.
Okay. So there's essentially three competing models right now. So there's what is probably best described as Labour Party Mark II Electric Boogaloo, which is let's do Labourism again. That's slightly more left-wing and on policy offering, although no less bureaucratic and no more democratic than either, just, you know, with a sort of left-wing face. Then on the other side, you have people who want a federal party, but they're not willing to advocate for it publicly, and nor are the Labour Mark II people.
What does it mean to have a federal party? You'd have like autonomy across regions, and then it would federate into some sort of national body. No,
you would have essentially like a coalition of local groups.
Oh, okay.
But when but what their actual proposals boil down to when you ask them about them privately, of course, because they won't say anything publicly, is that what they're really arguing for isn't federalism at all. It's feudalism. Basically, it's largely being driven by self-selected, independent socialist councillors who were elected during the last local elections across the country in various different places. And they essentially want to their existing local groups to become the branches of the new party, with them firmly in control.
So this is like dozens of George Galloways, like amalgamating themselves. Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, so essentially, although they're not as good as on anti-imperialism as George, but gotcha. Essentially what they want is feudalism. They want to be feudal lords reigning over local groups, and they want to cosplay as mass politicians without doing the actual work. Neither side has a strategy of how to turn these 800,000 sign-ups who signed up to the mailing list, the new party. None of them have any idea how to turn them from being party members, let's say if all 800,000 joined, into party activists, because deep down they don't really want that. They want to have their own fiefdoms that they control. And then on the other side, you have what I've been putting forward, which is a sort of British DSA-like model. Obviously with changes to fit the British political landscape.
DSA with British characteristics.
DSA with British characteristics that go straight past DSA's proto-party stage, straight into trying to build a radically democratic and genuinely mass socialist party of a type not seen on these shores.
In 100 years? And that
seems to be carrying a lot of weight amongst sort of like the rank and file of this nascent
party. Now you'll immediately get like a lot of listeners from the United States who are either burnt out DSA members or who have never been DSA members, who are like, oh no, don't replicate the issues that we have here in the United States, because obviously the DSA, because it's so central to what socialism means in the United States, comes in for a lot of critique. What I find interesting, and maybe this exists alongside, maybe you can tell me what the relationship is between the conception of the party as like a DSA with British characteristics versus what you've written about, which is the idea of the party as a sort of republic, the party republic, which is very fascinating to me. You've already analogized these different conceptions of the party as one being like feudalism, one being like capitalist politics, and then one being like the party republic. So talk a little bit about what you mean by a party republic versus maybe what a DSA with British characteristics would mean.
Well, a DSA with British characteristics and the party republic, as I conceive it, are one and the same. Democracy is ultimately when they're govern themselves. And that means in a socialist party that the members are the ruling class of that party, and that there's no party king or queen to rule over us, or a court that we have to display fealty to. It's a party republic in which all are equal, and none are more equal than anybody else. It's about, it's about fundamentally having a member-led organization that's free of sort of bureaucratic interference and domination.
Would you say that the fundamental question at this stage is a sort of a membership that has one vote per person, one vote, as opposed to a situation where the party has this entrenched leadership that can make proposals and you can sort of vote yes or no on the proposals?
When I talk about one member, one vote, they really do mean what you've just described as basically voting on referenda online with no sort of real participation. They're purely mobilized from above. They're not encouraged to, think critically or anything like that. It's whoever's got the biggest mailing list wins, essentially. I favor the party conference being its highest sovereign body because the membership is sovereign, and then the membership elect delegates from all member meetings. Now, the thing is, that is a form of one member, one vote, because it's based on the idea of an equal right to participate. And if you're a party member, the way you exercise your vote is by exercising your equal right to participate by attending a meeting. So I don't really see a contradiction between the two. But I do think the whole concept of one member, one vote is contested because it means different things to different people. But in the context of the Corbyn years and this new party, one member, one vote would be disempowering. And it would empower the people at the top. Because that's the effect that it had during the Corbyn years. Far from it being universal suffrage, it was universal disempowerment. You know, if you wanted to see change, you basically had to lobby the right people. Take, for example, the battle for mandatory reselection. For those of you in America wondering what the fuck is mandatory reselection, it's basically a closed primary system. So during the lifetime of each parliament, you would have a selection contest and local party members would vote on who they wanted their candidate to be. That probably seems quite normal. To you, but in this country, MPs kind of feel as if they've got a divine right to rule. Like once they're elected, it's a job for life, as far as they're concerned. And just trying to hold them account is seen as being undemocratic because what party members think, as far as they're concerned, doesn't matter. It's what the public think. But the problem they've got is that polling consistently shows that only a very, very small minority of the population, maybe something like 6%, vote for candidates in elections because they like the candidates. The overwhelming majority vote for the party. So their claim to have a kind of individualized mandate or whatever is built on sand because it's just not true. You know, nobody goes, I'm voting for so-and-so. They go, I'm voting Labour, or I'm voting Tory, or I'm voting Green, or something like that.
I think it was Friedrich Engels, based on his experience in Britain in the 19th century, that used the term political entrepreneurs for this type of activity. And as you said, like, extremely disempowering. I wonder maybe if we could focus in on the DSA question. When you say like a DSA for the British left, is that meaning multi-tenancy? As you understand the DSA?
A socialist party with open factions, with the right to dissent, freedom of speech, association, everything like that, year round, not just in the run up to conferences, which is what typifies most of the groups on the far left in Britain. But that actually has some weight to it, which is completely unlike the social democratic tradition in Britain or the Labourist tradition. See, I think it's quite difficult to describe the Labour Party as a social democratic party because its roots are completely unlike its European kin.
Interesting.
So the Labour Party and the Labour movement draws heavily from like Methodism. Do you know what Methodism is? It's like a form of
Christianity. The famous quip that British socialism is more Methodist than Marxist, right?
Yeah. So whereas the sort of great European social democratic parties are born out of the Marxist tradition, the classical Marxist tradition, Labour isn't born out of that. It's born out of churches and everything like that. I mean, years and years and years ago, there used to be such things as Labour churches, churches that were Methodist churches that were just for workers. And so that's kind of imbued the Labour Party with a whole different set of traditions, basically. That combined with its absolute loyalty to the British state as well.
Right. British state, which is appears to be an advanced state of deterioration, if no offense, if your military or finances are any indication. But I'm not sure you have much love for those institutions, such as it is. What struck me about your writing about the party question, and we don't always here on this podcast like have extended discussions about the party question. We have with our friend who lives in France, who's part of France Unbowed, and his relationship to the Mélenchon party we've talked about. But what fascinated me about your writing is your ability, your proclivity to analogize towards the Republic, which, you know, in the United States, I'm sure you know, we won our republic many, many years ago, and it is now very decrepit. But you guys, the Republican tradition is something far more radical in your system. Obviously, it goes back to Chartism, and it goes all the way through, I think, the kind of democratic movements in your country. But in your Civil War, you weren't ultimately able to permanently eliminate your monarchy. So, talk a little bit about republicanism and what it means in Britain, because I know from just watching from across the pond that Jeremy Corbyn's republicanism, he felt the need to, and I think this is a shame, he felt the need to hide his disdain for, or what I saw as his disdain, or at least disagreement with the institution of monarchy as he got closer and closer to power. What does republicanism mean for you broadly and in British political life in general?
Yeah, so I take inspiration from, you know, the Marxist tradition of democratic republicanism, which is something completely unlike liberal republicanism, basically. Mm-hmm. Whereas liberal republicans are concerned with, you know, sort of monarchical interference in democratic affairs or whatever, the Marxist democratic republican tradition is one that is opposed to domination in all forms. It doesn't matter whether it's from a king or from a capitalist, it's got to go. And when we talk about democratic republicanism in that sense, it is really synonymous with social and economic emancipation. So, look, I'm of the belief, I read a book many, many years ago. I'm sure some of your listeners are aware of it, a book by Ralph Miliband called The State and Capitalist Society. Mm. And in the final chapter of that book, he discusses, you know, this was written in 1969, I think. And he's writing about, you know, the kind of party that would be needed to challenge the capitalist state. And he says something along the lines of, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was, you know, you would need to reflect in your structures, practices, and modes of behavior the type of society you're aspiring to build, not the one that you came from. And I think that's what the DSA model, with some changes, represents to us who want a sort of party republic. It's because it is wholly member-led organization, and it's one in which the members are sovereign, whilst our experience of the past 100 years or whatever has been one of domination from above, like charismatic figures or cliques.
That's very edifying, and I think that overlaps with a lot of our work here on the left in the United States. Maybe it might be more appropriate to call your party, the new party, the new model Labour Party, Socialist Party in the UK, MUG, with British characteristics, because the Marxist Unity Group seems to be the tendency that you guys are closest to over there, which is a good thing. You know,
I like MUG. They're a good gang of people.
If only they could capture the DSA and turn it into the Party Republic, like you're arguing for in the UK.
Well, you never know, do you? I mean, they had a resolution, Principles of Party Building, I think that was passed by, was the last vote, DSA convention, passed by a supermajority. I agreed with all of it. I thought it was excellent, you know, and we're trying to apply that to our own work. See, the thing is, I think some people on your side of the pond think that I idealize the DSA. And I don't. I'm fully aware that, just as you said, you know, you've been aware of what we've been up to over here for the past 10 years. I've followed everything that's been going on in DFA for the past 10 years fairly closely. I did kind of joke with people a few years ago that I was going to join as soon as it was possible. But I thought people might think I was a bit weird. So, because I operate on from the position that, you know, one movement, one party. So it doesn't matter if you're in the United States or you're here in Britain. We're all in the same party, beat them. And, but yeah, no, I don't idealize the DSA. And in many ways, when I've spoken about a British DSA and everything, it's as much the type of party that those on the left of the DSA are aspiring to build, and me also projecting onto the DSA the type of party that I think we need to be building here.
Yeah, your ideological alignment with MUG is kind of interesting because, of course, they're heavily influenced by the Communist Party of Great Britain. Are there, right. Is that party, or are some other sects who have previously been very critical and remained outside the Labour Party interested in this party, interested in coming into it and building a sort of united front?
Yeah, no. So, I mean, the CPGB were always involved in the Labour Party. They had a front called Labour Party Marxists. That was like their front group inside. And obviously they have a newspaper called The Weekly Worker that I'm sure many people are aware of. It's considered like the people's magazine of the British left. You know, like your people's magazine. I don't mean it's the magazine of the people.
Like who's dating who?
Yeah, no, it's basically like that.
And, Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, their sectarian differences as they divorce or something like that. So the CPGB has similarly broken with the Labour Party and is now involved in your effort or not? Yes.
Yeah, no, they're now wanting to get involved in your party. Most of the far left want to get involved to varying different degrees. So you have the Socialist Party of England and Wales, which is the CWI, the Committee for Workers International, who used to be the militant tendency in the Labour Party. They want to get involved. They also want a sort of feudal party so that they can sort of continue to exist and essentially stand under the party's banner without actually going, you know, sort of knees deep.
A 21st century militant tendency.
Oh, I think that would be brilliant, by the way. Like, if we're going to have open factions in this party, why don't they revive the militant tendencies?
Yeah, why not?
I think it's a great
name. Maybe they'll get some seats in the Liverpool Council or something like that.
Well, you never know. You never know.
Never know.
But, so you have them. Then you have the SWP, who no one really knows what they want, but, you know, it's all about building the SWP. Then you have the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party, which is the other split from the militant tendency, who until 5 minutes ago were in the Labour Party and were essentially arguing for like left-wing Fabianism with Marxist characteristics, but who are now professing themselves to be revolutionary communists, which is quite hilarious. But a lot of them just want to build their own organisations and not actually build the party.
Mm-hmm. Sectarianism.
Yeah, I don't, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that they can all sort of unite around, you know, the idea of a party republic, British DSA, whatever you want to call it. But I think, you know, the culture of large swathes of the British left is you go into an organization, you get as many people as possible, and then you come out.
I think I think you might not know this, Max, because you might not follow our particular podcast. We've been around for some years, but, you know, not the most prominent in the world. You're sitting across from digitally one of America's, one of the United States of America's greatest trot watchers. Andy is, I think, has an encyclopedic knowledge of all the various different Trotskyist sects that exist in the world and how
just the Latin American ones in the mid 20th century.
I guess you've kind of fallen off, Andy, now that you pay attention to baseball more than Trotskyism. Yeah. But we'll forgive Andy, you for that.
Andy, you would love my mate Jack. He drew up a family tree of British Trotskyism. I will send it to you. You're going to love it.
Yeah, please do. Please do. You know, I wrote a book about the Posadist tendency that had a very strong British section.
I mean, their greatest proponent by now is Paul Mason. I don't know if you know who Paul Mason is.
Yeah.
Sometimes, no.
Oh, he likes your party.
No. He's a Posadist.
Oh, he's a Posadist.
Well
check this out.
He's something weird. I don't know.
check this out.
It's big into the nuclear war.
If the DSA with British characteristics can just get their hands on the Trident system, we could put an end to this global capitalist system once and for all. DSA with British characteristics gets the nukes, fires off the thermonuclear war, capitalism over. That's it. I just solved the whole problem.
Personally, I think of something that could unite the American working class and the British working class, which is basically we take all the people on the Epstein list and sort of pedos in general. I mean, put them all on an island with all the capitalists and then we just drop all our nukes on them.
Well, there you go. And then we don't have any more nukes to worry about then.
Yeah.
Rest in peace, Noam Chomsky. let me ask you another sort of sectarian question. So when this party was announced, I heard some people say, why are we starting a new party? Why don't we all just move to the Green Party?
Mm.
And I guess there's been some sort of left-wing drift from the Green Party as well. What's your take on that dynamic?
So I think a lot of the people that have drifted towards the Green Party, by and large, they're very electorally focused. They want a left government as soon as possible. Many, you know, they're latter-day converts to sort of greenism. If you want. And they see the Green Party as being radically democratic compared to other political parties in Britain, which is true. But they have an incredibly small membership. And their politics can really be best described as sort of liberals with bright ideas. Like they all mean well. You know, they really do believe in what they're arguing for, and I think it's fantastic that Zach Polanski got elected as Green Party leader and everything like that. That's all good, but it's kind of based in a sort of naive view of governing, right? Because from everything that I've seen, they essentially think what happens is you elect enough members of parliament, they form a government, and then you get to carry your program out, right? But the history of the British state shows that whenever anybody tries to do anything even mildly radical, because, I mean, look, if you look at Corbyn's program, you know, Lenin would have scoffed at it. It wasn't that radical. It was very mild social democracy. Personally, I don't think it was fully up to the task at hand, right? But the problem was that, you know, you would be sending people into the state. Well, no, you wouldn't even really be sending people into the state. You'd be sending people into governmental office. They would come up against massive opposition from the state bureaucracy and from the press and from the whole shebang, the whole capitalist shebang. There'd be a run on the pound, you know, the markets would probably crash somewhat or whatever. Greens don't factor that in. They just think, right, you elect the government and then we build eco-social democracy or whatever. And it just seems very naive to me. And if you try to have these conversations with them, they sort of, R&R and don't really want to discuss it. Sorry, I keep interrupting you.
No, please. You're the guest here. All I was going to say, it just reminded me immediately of Harold Wilson, the allegations that there was a coup against him in the 1970s, a Labour prime minister, and he obviously wasn't a very radical man. And you had a, as I understand it, a relatively mobilized and organized working class in the 1970s, and that couldn't even stop the deep state over there in Britain from overthrowing a Labour prime minister. So this is obviously something that people in your party are aware of. Maybe the Green Party types are a little bit more naive about that.
I would say that an awful lot of people on the sort of like Corbynite wing of British politics are just as naive about it. And I think that's largely down to there being a severe lack of political education. Now, look, when I talk about political education, I'm not talking about teaching people what to think. I'm talking about teaching people how to think, to give them the tools to critically engage with the world. And that was something that was never done inside the Labour Party at all. Inside the Labour Party, and inside the British Labour movement more widely, there is a strong culture of anti-intellectualism, very strong culture of it. And because there's a strong culture of anti-intellectualism, when you try to raise these issues publicly, oh, that's just an intellectual concern, you know, it's going to be fine, yada, yada, yada. I mean, I always remember repeatedly saying, smashing my head up against the wall during the Corbyn years, particularly after the 2017 election, look, let's say you do get elected, right? Let's say a left government did get elected in 2017 or 2019. So the first thing you would have to do to stand any chance of carrying your program out would be that you would have to bring, I don't know, 100,000 people with you inside the state, right? To act as organizers at every level to counteract the upper echelons of the trade of the civil service. And so on and so on and so on, right? Anybody listening to this knows what I'm on about. Now, that might have been possible if we had done any form of sort of like, you know, political education, cadreization, however you want to call it. The problem would be that then nobody would have been left on the outside to organize. Everyone would have gone into the state. In many ways, you know, that's obviously a completely different situation. But in many ways, that was the problem, one of the great problems that Syriza had that it never reckoned with, right? Was that they took all their best people with them into the state. And obviously, they were unable to do anything, whether out of naivety or just lack of will, you know? But they then had nobody left on the outside to organise a sort of counterforce to those from above. And that was the situation we were going to find ourselves in. And that's the situation the British left is still going to find itself in. But the problem is that when you raise these things, some people don't understand what you're on about, right? And that's not because they're idiots or anything like that, because they're really not. But it's just because these questions have never been posed to them before.
It sounds like Podemos might be in a similar situation to Syriza in that regard, where they just had to sort of become like a normal Labour Party to some degree. One last question I have about these dynamics as the party forms, also sort of along sectarian lines. And I will say that the way you sort of describe political education, the sort of political education that's necessary within this party, I think DSA is a very good example of that. Because, you know, I have an outsider's perspective of it. I've never been a member, but I do notice that people who get heavily involved in the DSA because of its multi-tendency character do have to think about the political differences between different tendencies within it and have to understand what those differences are and understand how to argue for their position. So I agree with you that the DSA is very dynamic as a result of that. And I think one of the early political tests, aside from the question of how decisions are made, how the party is structured, is the fact that some of the people in the forming party come from the pro-Palestine movement. They're not exactly coming from the left necessarily. And some of these people have somewhat social conservative politics, notably Blackburn MP Adnan Hussein. And so this has raised the question of transphobia within the party, because Adnan Hussein has stated some things about, you know, needing to for women to have their own spaces, and that trans women aren't women. And so this has made a lot of people think, like, well, is your party going to be sort of vulgar populist, where we're not going to take on important questions like this? So how do you see that shaping up, and what do you suggest should be done about it?
So I think the best way of describing the rest of the Independent Alliance group, other than Jeremy and Zara, is that they're good on Gaza and absolutely god-awful on everything else. They're not socialists. They would never describe themselves as such. Most of them are landlords. A few of them are lawyers, small businessmen, sort of petty bourgeois types. At least one of them was a Liberal Democrat until quite recently. So they're not on the left, so to speak. And they have absolutely wild ideas as to what this party should be. You know, it shouldn't be too left-wing, because it will be exclusionary. I mean, one of them, Shoka Adam, said in the New Statesman the other day that we can't be harsh on landlords. Like, as if, you know, landlords should be a protected characteristic or something under the Equality Act. Like, and the landlords should be protected. I mean, it's just utterly fucking stupid.
Not if you're a landlord.
I mean, they are landlords. I think it's what? So there's four of the Gaza independents, and I'm certain that at least three of them are landlords. Mm. Right? They either directly rent properties out, or they own companies that rent properties out for them.
You're going to have a J.K. Rowling for landlords.
Yeah, so essentially, it's not in their class interest to be an associate's part.
So do you think that the transphobia issue is them starting to drive the wedge in this new party, saying that,
definitely,
like, you know, if you're a leftist, you probably give a shit about trans people, or if you're a trans person yourself, and this is a way to make sure that you're not a factor in this part.
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it. The way in which the whole one freaks, I got more than one. Fuck daddy and daughter one. Tory putting in Labour, this that Jeremy Corbyn
one. Awkward one, race me there, wait. Hey folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall. Can't look at my mentions, that's area 51. I'm so close to my pension, my left wrist is 61. My left wrist retiring. My apprentice trying to give Alan sugar. There's no way I can Jordan 4s or Jordan.